So if you treat them like troubled, broken, manipulative, lying kids, they will respond accordingly, and they will more often lie to you and more often demonstrate that they're broken and they're troubled. And solution-focused practices helped me come back to what I knew also as a good teacher: what you expect is what you will get.
That is Simply Focused with Elva Chani and Dominic Gilda for Live and Joy and Deep.
Are you ready for this new episode? Then please welcome your hosts, Elfie Cherney and Dominic Godad.
Hello and welcome back to episode number 99 of the Simply Focus podcast.
We are here today on Zoom with Sharon Casey. Hi, Sharon.
Good morning.
Sharon, it's so good to see you. It's morning in Montreal. We are here in Switzerland. It's already afternoon, and it's lovely to meet on Zoom together and to talk about all the amazing work you did over many, many years. And we are very, very excited to have you here today and seeing you bring up so many beautiful memories. Our first encounter in Montreal, actually, at last year's SFPTA conference, which you co-organized together with Brigitte Lavoie. And you are working with Brigitte. You're a couple and you do just really wonderful work in a lot of different areas that we are excited to touch on, and particularly in your area of education.
So Sharon, you're a solution-focused practitioner and teacher. You have also trained many, many practitioners in suicide prevention together with Brigitte Lavoie and are now consulting a lot of schools. And it's an interesting topic for us because there's so many networks that are right now forming about solution-focused practices in schools. And we are very, very excited to talk with you about that.
And well, since Montreal, we are in contact with each other. And I remember, I think it was Brenda Salter Minden who brought you a frog stuffed animal to the conference. And Bibi was so excited about the frog that you lended it to her for the few days of the conference. And Bibi, meanwhile, received some emails from Emily the Frog and is so excited about it. And the other day, you also sent us a lovely game that we would really love to talk about. But before we get into it, what is it, Sharon, that fascinates you about solution focus?
I think what really fascinates me the most is how solution-focused practices act as a sort of second language. It's more than just a set of techniques. It's a way of thinking about and talking about people and problems. And what fascinates me is how effective it can be, whether or not it's a natural approach for you. Because I have to say, full disclosure, in terms of my natural personality and who I am as a person, I may be the least solution-focused person on the planet. In the solution-focused community, there are people who are just born to be solution-focused. They are naturally optimistic. They believe in people. They're always drawn to strengths. They're always looking for good intentions and the best in people. My wife is like that. If she had not found solution-focused, she would have invented it because that's who she is as a person. And then there are people like me who are, you know, somewhat cynical and sarcastic, pessimistic. I remember one time when my daughter was about 10 saying in a conversation, well, you know, I don't like to judge people. And she said, but mommy, you judge people like it's your job. So, you know, people like me who it is not my personality, but when I was looking for an approach that would help me help young people, it was the one that had evidence that demonstrated it works. And I decided to have confidence and to try this approach, to read the books, to get the training. And I use it because it works, whether it matches my personality or not. And the more I use it, the more I become solution focused. It has an influence. It's still a second language. It will probably never be my first language, but I'm so comfortable in it now that I can switch. You know, we talk about code switching. I can switch codes really quickly, and it has a wonderful impact on me. I feel so good when I'm speaking that language and when I'm doing that. So I'm really fascinated, but at the same time, I don't have to become a different person. I can keep my sarcastic edge, and I can be cranky and I can be a bit cynical, but it helps me rise above that when I need to move things forward, when I need to work with people.
Isn't that nice to have choices like that, to decide on when you want to be like that or more like that?
And especially for us, since we're a solution-focused family, sometimes we just need to put it aside. She's always solution-focused. So we were having an argument one time because she had asked me a scale question. And I was in a bad mood and I just bristled that that's a technique. This was before I came to work with her. Don't do your work stuff with me. I don't want it. And she said, well, what do you want? I ask how you're doing. And you say, I'm fine. I'm fine. That gives me no information. So as we're sort of getting into this argument, my daughter, who's in between us, maybe 10 or 11 again, she puts up her hands and says, okay, stop. You stop asking scale questions. You answer with a number. And then she walked away. It was the single best couple therapy thing I've ever heard. And for the last 6 years, that's what we do. When Lujan is concerned, she says, how are you? And I say, oh, I'm six or I'm three.
So she never needs to ask a scaling question again, because it's part of your how are you already.
Yeah, it's understood. I don't like the question, but I can answer. So it's that idea of, I think the code switching fascinates me, because I think when I started to learn about solution focus, my initial reaction was, okay, I don't know if I can do this. I don't see the world in the same way. My brain is very analytical. I'm very fascinated by why questions, which are not very helpful in solution focused practice. This is my personality, and I don't know if I want to change that. And I've learned over the years that I don't have to, but having access to another way of looking at the world is really good for my heart as well.
And what attracted you towards this approach?
Initially, it was the idea that it was a way to help with practically zero possibility of doing harm. So when I first learned solution focused practices, I was working in drug treatment. I was working in a therapeutic community. So that's a treatment model based on former addicts who will operate in a community setting. It's like a big family in residential care, and they help people who are struggling with addiction. So at the time, I had been hired as a teacher. So I came in with no background. I was the only staff member who had never used drugs. I used to joke that it was a block to my career that I'd never done heroin. My bosses, the supervisors, the director, everybody else was a former addict. And it was a beautiful model. That family, the healing power of relationships really attracted to me. But there was an attitude, which sometimes happens in drug treatment, of a real sort of distrust of clients, of always assuming that you're being lied to and manipulated, and needing to break down people's resistance and make them confront the reality. And there was a harshness sometimes in that model that I found really difficult, because we were working with teenagers, you know, 14 to 20 year olds. And it was hard for me to go to work every day seeing a group of teenagers as liars or manipulators or damaged, broken people. I felt it went against everything I knew as a teacher. That's not how I had learned to teach. So when I found solution focused, it was a way to do the helping piece that was not about confronting resistance. And they used to have an expression of put your reality in your face, but very much like, and it was done with caring intentions, but the impact was we will break them down and we will build them up again. And I knew that not all of them were going to be built up again, that about half the kids were going to leave within the first month. And the ones who did 6 months of residential treatment actually did very well, and they came out with amazing skills, but we lost half of them. And that half who left, all we did was the breaking down part. So I was looking for an approach that would not do harm. And at the time, I knew therapists who were using solution focused, who lent me books, who got me interested in the approach. And it really built from there. And I think the other thing, you know, there was the, this won't hurt. At the very worst, if I'm not very good at it, it won't be effective, but it won't harm anyone. So for me, that was the baseline. And then solution focused practice is much more like teaching than traditional therapy. There's a much smaller gap between what we know about good teaching. I used to train therapists in suicide prevention, and solution-focused ideas were very far from what they'd learned in university, from very far from what they were getting from their professional order. It was very far from, and Quebec, you know, there's still a huge psychoanalytical movement, for example. I don't know if there's anything further from solution-focused practice than psychoanalysis. So I was always trying to help them bridge that gap with teaching. Solution-focused practice is very much like what we've been saying in the teaching field for 50 years. So for me, those two things made it a really ideal approach.
And what differences did solution-focused make for you and also those teenagers?
I think children and teenagers are particularly susceptible to self-fulfilling prophecies. So if you treat them like troubled, broken, manipulative, lying kids, they will respond accordingly, and they will more often lie to you and more often demonstrate that they're broken and they're troubled. And solution focused practices helped me come back to what I knew also as a good teacher: what you expect is what you will get. So can you look at them as, yes, they have difficulties. Some of those teenagers had done things that violated my value system, but they were also young people who were struggling, who were coping, who were surviving, who had done the best they could in a very difficult situation. I mean, in residential drug treatment, there are very few teenagers who don't come from very difficult backgrounds, abuse, negligence, sexual abuse. You know, they had managed to rise above that and function. That idea of change for me was getting me back to the idea of, can I see them as capable? They're doing their best. They have good intentions. They're trying to get their needs met. And they have skills. They have abilities, even honestly, that come from their drug use. You know, I've worked with young people who were runners for organized crime. They worked with, in organized crime to sell drugs. If you take away the illegal nature, they were fantastic business people. Mm-hmm. They were organized. They had good communication skills. They were independent. You know, it was that idea of focusing on their strengths that brought me back to what I loved about teaching.
So I'm really kind of intrigued by what you said about yourself, having this personality of being problem focused and then also really embracing and appreciating the solution focused approach. And I know you work a lot in schools and with schools that are also problem focused, and you plant the seeds of solution focus there. So how do you do that? And what is it that fascinates you about doing that?
One of the things that really strikes me is, because I don't have access to the children necessarily, when I go into schools, it's to meet with teachers and principals and counseling staff. Right now, just the way my projects are organized, I don't go into classrooms. So I no longer have access to students directly. I have access to the staff who work with them. And the thing that I really find amazing is the impact it has on them in their own professional life. I worked with an elementary school where, you know, we said we have funding to do a solution focused project. We have to choose a cohort. We have to find a place where we can start to implement. We're going to train the staff. We'll run a project for one school year and then we'll evaluate. And we chose a school where, you know, the teachers were coming into the project saying, we need to do this with grade 3-4. So that's 8-9-year-olds. And this is the worst cohort in the history of the school. This is the worst class. And that's where you, so come and fix them. So it was very intimidating as, okay, we're going to start with the worst class you've ever had. Okay, deep breath. I believe in this. This can work. Small changes lead to big changes. And we went in and I had one teacher in particular who was saying, you know, when these children were in kindergarten in the same school, I told myself when they get to me, if I really can't handle it, I can take a sick leave. So, you know, that's how concerned. And these were caring, wonderful teachers who, you know, there are children in that school who I don't know would function in any other school, but it works there because the teachers go beyond every day. These are not, you know, burned out cynical teachers. These are a group of extraordinary teachers with this cohort that, it, you know, had particular difficulties. So to watch that teacher go through the training in the spring, and you can see in their eyes that they're thinking, oh yeah, okay. But we're willing to give it a try because we love these children and we'll do what it takes. And then to come back in September and have them say, we've been in school for 3 weeks and this is one of the best classes I've ever had. You know, to watch the look on in their faces, that was extremely rewarding because I didn't see the children, but I saw, you know, if the teacher is happy, the children will be happy. And to see that transformation with fairly simple training, fairly simple techniques, we didn't have to move mountains to get that transformation. We had to start with some basic concepts and tie it to who they already were as people and get them started. Then, you know, it's like a snowball rolling down a hill. It got bigger and bigger without necessarily a lot of participation on my part. So to watch that transformation was really rewarding.
That's amazing. And I'm super curious now, of course, what was particularly useful that you with the teachers did together that helped them to bring it into the classrooms?
I mean, I think we had people in the system who were already curious about solution-focused practices, so that helped. And part of it came through the suicide prevention training that we do in Quebec has a solution-focused aspect. So it's not really full solution-focused practice, but we use some of the techniques in suicide intervention, and I had trained some staff members in suicide prevention. So I had allies on the ground going in who were already interested. We did an introductory conference and the principal attended and she, you know, Brigitte did the conference and she was hooked. She said, you know, okay, when can I start? I want this for my school. So we had some leaders in the school and then we came in and we did an introductory conference. And I think one of the things that was really successful was making it light and making it humorous and making it non-threatening. You know, so I think the advantage that I had was I could say, I am a teacher And I know what it's like. Every year a new consultant comes into your school and tries to tell you they can revolutionize all your practice and solve all your problems, and you just need to buy this program. You know, because I don't know about elsewhere in the world, but in Canada, that's what happens. Every year or two, there's a new approach to social emotional learning, to behavior problems, to mental health. And the teachers get tired of, you know, what is the program for this year? So I was able to come in and say, I know that that doesn't work. And if you want to work with us, we're going to do things differently. So I think, you know, that credibility of having been there, of not pretending we were going to sell them a program. Solution focused is not a program. It's a way of looking at people and at contexts and problems and working through them differently. And to be able to say, this is harder than it looks, but it's worth it. And to be able to do that with humor, I think really helped us create curiosity. And once that introductory conference, you know, which was a few hours, was done, then they wanted to know more. So then we could come in and train them. I did two full days of training in the spring with the idea that they would start in the fall. And then we had coaches within the school system who I supervise. So I work with them directly, and then they coach the staff team. So we had a whole system, you know, for a small scale project, we managed to put a fair amount of support in around them. And then we just focused on getting their own natural abilities rolling because they wanted this. They wanted to see the students as capable and competent. They wanted to work on strengths. I think that's what happens with teachers. If you have a good teacher preparation program, you learn all of these ideas, and then you hit the school system, and it doesn't take long to have it ground out of you if you don't have support. You know, you adopt the culture around you, which is problem focused. So we got them back to what they really believed. We gave them fairly simple tools, and we let them do the work, and we really had quite impressive results.
Oh, I really love what you're saying here. And it reminds me of a very important thing. Actually, I remember Brigitte highlighted in the first podcast we did with her, where she was talking about implementing the suicide prevention program in the region of Quebec and noticing that you cannot implement a solution-focused program with a problem-focused attempt. And what I hear, what you did here is just a pure solution-focused way of inviting people to try out something new, seeing the resources of the teachers, seeing the strength, seeing all the things that are already there and just sparking their curiosity and then, yeah, bringing that forward to the people they work with. And I really love that. And I think it's a really important message that I think particularly people who are not that long with solution focus, and I think a lot of teachers are really excited about solution focus, and then you don't have the system, you don't have the school where you can implement it because there are other rules playing around, and just seeing that there are slight things you can do that make a difference is something I really like to hear. And I'm curious, what did the teachers tell you that changed for them?
When they started to apply what they learned in training, one of the realizations was, okay, this is real. This is not about, you know, the expression they use is unicorns and rainbows. This is not about unicorns and rainbows and everything is happy and rose-colored glasses. This is real. This is difficult. It looks very easy on paper. You know, when I send them the copy of my presentation, all of the concepts, all the techniques look very simple on paper. But when you apply it, it's complex, but it works and it's rewarding. So I think for them, it was that idea that it touched something personally for them. This is how I want to be with my students. This is who I want to be. And I need better tools to do it. And here are a set of tools. And one of the things that I've said all along is solution-focused practice is not the only way to do this. You know, it has things in common with other programs, with other approaches. From my point of view, with the training I have and my work experience, it's the easiest way to learn it and apply it so that it really works. But I encourage them to make connections with things they already knew. And right now, quite honestly, in that school, everything that works, we get credit for it, whether it's solution focused or not. You know, they're making connections, and it's that. So for me, it's that once the teachers could feel like not just that they were making a difference, but that they were getting back to who they really were. This is how I want to be with these children. I want to be kind. I want to be compassionate. I want to be hopeful. I want to believe in them. And I've got a structure now that encourages me to do that. And not just coaching and training, but I've got an activity at the beginning of the school year. There is a solution-focused way to begin my school year that's different from what I used to do. And when there's a discipline problem, there's a solution-focused way to do that that's different from what I used to do. So there's concrete tools. You know, the attitude is not enough if you don't give them concrete tools to act on it.
And how do you start the solution-focused school year?
With the preferred teacher. We actually, you know, develop, of course, the teachers personalized it with their own analogies and their own games. But the beginning of the school year starts with welcome to our class. Let's imagine, you know, we're at the end of the year in June and we have had the best year ever. What does that year look like? What happened over the year? So it's group activities and brainstorming and drawings. For example, one of the teachers had a magic lamp with a genie and you would get three wishes. So she asked her class what their three wishes would be. And they broke down into small groups. Each group had to come up with a list of three wishes. And then she took all of the class's input and tried to find three or four things that would incorporate everything the kids said. They made a poster that they put on the wall. And these are the class rules. So in previous years, the teacher would have started by saying, here is the code of conduct. Don't talk. Don't run in the halls. Don't push. You know, do not. And the children would have agreed with that and listened, but it would have been imposed from outside. It wouldn't have been connected to them. Instead, she did it with them, and then they started to enforce it themselves. I remember her talking about a group activity where one child was doing all the work and another child stopped and said, no, wait a minute, look at our poster. We said in our class, everybody gets to participate. We have to get everyone to work in this group. You know, so it wasn't the teacher told us, it was look at the poster on the wall. This is ours. This belongs to us and we're going to do it. So based on, even if we had only done that, I'm really convinced that even if there was no other follow-up, that would have made a huge difference.
That reminds me of a story that Anna Julia Szabo told us. She's also a teacher here in Switzerland. And when they have breaks and the kids, they go out and they come back after break and they're maybe late and they didn't put their stuff away and things like that. She scales with them and asks them, well, what kind of break do we want to have on a scale from 1 to 10? Mm-hmm. And then they scale, let's say, to a 7, say, okay, what would it look like? And so they scale their breaks. And then when they have a break like that, she just comes and says, okay, let's look at the break we just had. Where are we on a scale of 1 to 10 at this break? I said, well, we're at a 3 or whatever it is. Okay, so what was it that already worked well? That we're at a 3. What do you want to be in next break? A 7? Okay. So how might we notice in the next break that we're at a 7? What would we see each other doing differently and things like that? So really engaging the kids in these conversations and also letting them set up their rules that are mostly very much in line with what we as adults or teachers want. And that's like me, for example. Don't tell me what I shouldn't do. I will for sure do it. Let me find out what I should do or should not do or want to do or want not to do, and I will follow that.
I think the teachers were very skeptical about some of the negotiated things. You know, can we really hand this over to students? And I knew they could, because what I knew is that the children would come up with exactly the same rules because they want the same things. They want a quiet learning environment. They want respectful, kind interactions. They want to play at recess without fighting. They want to get along. So, you know, the language is theirs and the images belong to the children, but they wanted exactly the same things. And all of the teachers unanimously said, if I had made the list myself, that's what I would have written. And I left it up to them. And there were little things. Of course, one of the classes, you know, in their perfect school year, every Friday they would have pizza and dinosaurs.
Well, the pizza, I can imagine. How did they do that with the dinosaurs?
So during the brainstorming, and the teacher just had a wonderful reaction. She laughed and she said, wouldn't that be cool? What else? So it was just accepting that, yes, some of their answers were imaginative and playful and funny, and they were having fun with it. And all she had to do was go along with the joke. Yeah, I would love to have dinosaurs too. That would be so cool, especially for science class. What else? And so those moments, just to see that the children wanted the same thing, I think it changes the perception of the teacher. When you realize that if you give them the tools to discuss it, they do want the same things we do. They may not know how to get there. If you ask them the question, you know, we'll have to go back and ask them how they've done that in the past and what their skills are. But basically, they want the same thing. I think that from, you know, air quotes, the worst cohort the school has ever seen. And even they want respect and kindness and getting along. And they want to be able to do their work. You know, that was one of the things that the children talked about. They wanted to be able to do their work. It wasn't just about having fun and having no homework and having dinosaurs. They wanted to be able to do their work. And that came from them. I think that really helped the teachers with their perception of the groups.
Yeah, and I think that, well, particularly talking about respect, also giving them space where they can share what's important for them is something that makes a difference, because in this moment you show them that their voice counts. And I think that particularly younger kids, but also adolescents, they're used that people tell them how the world works and that they're not asked how they want their world to work. So I really love the idea of starting a school year with the preferred future, the way you described it, because everyone has possibility to co-create and to share what's important for him or her.
Mm-hmm. We haven't done projects yet in the same way with high school students, but one of the things we've discussed with teenagers is you can do these activities, but be careful to protect the teenage ego. Don't give them activities where they might feel it's foolish or you might not get answers. If you're really concerned and you don't feel confident, maybe you can ask them to write about it. You know, I used to teach English. I was a high school English teacher. Every year began with a writing assignment because I needed to assess their writing skills. So if I don't feel comfortable as a teacher doing a group discussion when I don't know my students, I could ask them to write about it. Because when they're writing privately and no one's reading it, they will tell you the truth. So, you know, we thought about even teenagers, we can do this. I'm convinced that teenagers would handle the discussion as well, but the teachers might not be, and they might need a safety measure. You know, I mean, I know in my teaching career, the points where I handled my most difficult teenagers were when I was willing to be vulnerable. My first classroom assignment, I had just graduated with my Bachelor of Education, and I was sent back to my high school to replace one of my former high school teachers who was a screamer. Like, she managed her class by screaming. And I was replacing her when she was sick for one day. Of course, we all know, I'm sure it's the same thing around the world. When you have a replacement teacher, it's free for all. It's open season. And this class was a cohort also with a reputation. When I walked in, a guy in the back row said, "This is 9D, D for demented, D for delinquent, D for deranged." So deep breath. And I thought, okay, what kind of teacher do you want to be? And I sat down on a desk at the front of the room and I said, "I'd like to introduce myself. My name is Sharon, and this is why I became a teacher." And I explained to them my dream of becoming a teacher and how I wanted to help and how I wanted to connect with young people and the kind of teacher I wanted to be. And I said, "I'm just here replacing today, but I'm really excited that this is my first opportunity to be with the group." And 9D demented and deranged, they got very quiet. They didn't do any work, but I wandered around the class chatting with them while they pretended to work, and I didn't have to kick anyone out and I didn't have to discipline anyone. And we had it. And I'm really convinced that, you know, when teenagers connect with sincerity, they respond. Even if they're gruff, even if they're a bit sarcastic, if you let them have their teenage shell, they connect with that.
Your story really reminds me of a great teacher I had. So back in school, and this will maybe show how old I am already, we had this subject of, you know, like learn how to typewrite and stenography. And I really did not like that a lot. But she, in every lesson, she took some minutes to share personal story, to really connect with us. And she gave something and she asked us. And I remember the whole class were telling her stories that no other teacher heard. So that's on the connecting level. But on the other side, I remember that I really like to go into this class. And even if I didn't really enjoy particularly stenography, I was encouraged to learn about it because I liked her. And I think when I think back of my school career, a lot of the subjects I really liked were connected to the teachers I had. And whether I liked or didn't like the teachers were often connected with how the teachers treated us as a class. And not only me personally, but really us as a class.
Mm-hmm. That sincere and genuine connection. I had high school teachers who worked very hard at trying to be cool, who used inappropriate language in class, and who really tried to be edgy and cool. And as teenagers, we went along with it because you have to, but these are not the teachers we remember. You know, one of the teachers I remember was a physics teacher. She used to make her own jewelry using plastic pill bottles and wax crayons. She was very out there. She was very unusual. She was very odd. It would probably even have all kinds of diagnoses now, autism spectrum or whatever. She was just a very odd, the last person you would expect teenagers to respond to, but she loved physics. And she had memorized the distance between all the planets and could recite it. We were just so charmed by her love of what she was doing and wanting to reach us that the rest of it, and yes, we made jokes because we were teenagers and we weren't always, but among ourselves, but we had a real affection and connection to her in her class. Things went relatively well for a subject that is not easy. You know, it's the genuineness. And for me, solution focus helps us to make that genuine connection because we see students as kind. If I believe they are kind and I respond accordingly, they are more likely to be kind to me. And if I treat them like they're dangerous little thugs, they won't be kind to me. You know, it's that solution focus is one of the best tools to work on that self-fulfilling prophecy.
This is one of the things I love about working with solution focused approaches, that I usually meet brilliant people and I really like them.
Mm-hmm. And solution focus is the perfect approach for a sincere and really interested conversation. I think there's so much appreciation in these questions and so much genuine interest in seeing another person making progress. And I also see that other people see that and they acknowledge that and they respond to that, like the students you just told us.
And I think what's hopeful is you can learn, even if it's not a natural response, you can learn to do that if you want to. You know, another of the teachers that I'm working with at various points in the training, and she was very funny, very sarcastic, edgy, a lot like me. I really connected with her because her personality was similar. And she would tell me regularly, you know, I'm the last person who's going to do this solution focused stuff. Yeah. And we would joke, but I knew she really wanted it. And then she would come back once the school year started with her solution focused stories of being at her wit's end with a girl in her class and finally sitting down with her and saying, I'm writing your report card next week. And what she would have done, I think, before was say, you know, if you don't change your behavior, if you don't start working harder, if you don't start paying attention in class, I'm going to have to write this to your mother and she will see how badly. But because she was trying to implement solution-focused practices, she said, what would you like me to write on your report card? What are you hoping that I write on your report card? I think it was actually a few weeks in the future. What do you want me to write on your report card? So they talked about that, what the girl was hoping for. And she talked about, you know, examples where she'd already seen little bits of that. And they planned together how the girl could work on those behaviors so that when the report card time came around, those comments would actually be there. So, you know, for me, this was a dedicated teacher who genuinely loves her students. And what she needed was just a tool, a package to have the conversation that she already wanted to have.
Isn't that beautiful? So Sharon, looking back at your solution-focused journey, if there is one thing we have not yet talked about, one thing you have not yet shared that really made a difference for you and that could also inspire other people, what could that be?
I think especially for people working in education, the idea that on a scale of 1 to 10, you don't have to get to 10. I think teachers and educators are constantly surrounded by perfect models that for very hopeful and optimistic people, those are goals to strive for and they move forward. But for other people, they're discouraging. You look at the solution focused school where the entire staff team has been trained and selected, and it's a special alternative school, and they're doing everything from top to bottom is solution focused. And you look at that model and you think, but I can never have that. Or you watch the half dozen Hollywood movies of the perfect teacher who comes into the disadvantaged neighborhood and heals all of the children with his brilliance or her brilliance. You know, those things used to depress me profoundly. I cannot be Michelle Pfeiffer. I cannot be the teacher in Stand and Deliver. I cannot be Sidney Poitier in To Sir With Love. Those models were too beautiful and they were not accessible to me. So I think one of the things that I've learned in my career is that you don't have to get to 10. If GARTSA school, which is the school we cite as the 10, that's a lovely shining goal in the distance that might motivate me, but I need to talk about a 6 and I need to value a 6, and a 6 needs to be worth working on and a spectacular success because that 6 will make a difference. And I think my work in suicide prevention helped me with that because we couldn't do complete SF training in suicide prevention. We didn't have the context. We didn't have the time. We taught them a little bit of solution focus to help with suicide, and it had big impacts. And it helped me see that those lower numbers on the scale are worth working on. So if you only have one teacher and you're alone in your building, you can do a little bit. And if you have two teachers, it might be a bit easier. And if you have a principal even so, but you can get started without a budget, without an external consultant. It takes a willingness to examine your practice, to learn and to read, and hopefully to connect with at least one other person that you can share ideas with. If you have that, you can have results that will be quite surprising.
And you support teachers to be on a six or to get to a six and to get where they want to be with a lot of tools and resources on your website. And you'll also find all those resources and tools in the resource section of this podcast. So go to www.sfontour.com/simplyfocuspodcast and then go to episode number 99.
So Sharon, let's come to the challenge of the week.
I think I would come back to that last idea we talked about. I would encourage people to look for their sixes, the sixes or the fives or the fours that they can be really proud of, because that four could have been a three or a two or a one. So, you know, can we stop reaching for the stars and just allow ourselves to celebrate our fours and our sixes and to recognize the effort it takes to get there and not see it as just a stop along the way to 10, that in itself is worth doing. And if that's where we are, that we should celebrate that.
Thank you, Sharon. Thank you very, very much. For me, it was super inspiring to talk with you. As usual, there's always something new. There's always a lot of things that really spark my enthusiasm and also just make me happy. We are curious now to hear from all of you what inspired you about the podcast with Sharon. So please go and comment on www.sfontour.com/simplyfocuspodcast and then go to episode number 99. What inspires you might also inspire someone else. So please take a moment to comment. And also connect with the Solution Focus community. So as we mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, it's possible to reach out to other teachers easier than ever before. There is a new Solution Focus network, and they will have Zoom meetings every third of the month where you can connect with practitioners who apply Solution Focus in schools or with schools and share best practices, inspire each other, and just celebrate the 6, 5, 4, and 7 where we are.
So Sharon, thank you very much for being on the podcast today with us and also for everything you did at the Solution Focus Brief Therapy Conference in Montreal. And I remember how Bibi could just run around behind your desk and you had so many things to do in your organizing team. And you just always had this patience. You always took her by the hand. She was really part of the organizing team. And that meant so much to us. And also the heart-touching encounters with you and with your family, with your partner, with your daughter, and just seeing you as a family, such a beautiful picture. So thank you also for being role models for so many other people out there and really using Solution Focus in your private life and in everything you do.
It's been a wonderful experience. It's a Saturday morning and now I want to get to work, because talking about this has me fired up, and now I think I will spend the afternoon working and enjoying that.
Thank you very much, Sharon, and we're very much looking forward to seeing you soon again. So thank you and goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Wow, what a great episode again.
This was Simply Focus Podcast with Alfie Cherney and Dominic Godet.
Your podcast for a life in joy and ease.